I would say philanthropic initiatives aligned to those kind of that roadmap. So I would say that could be an approach. That's at least the approach I am taking. I set up a 2047 document for myself. I set it up with a five-year kind of roadmap, and I looked at what could be the tipping point projects that I could be associated with, which will ensure that if I hit the tipping point in the 5 years, then it creates a virtuous cycle that then sustains itself over the next 15.
Hello and a warm welcome to a very special podcast series, Unusual Suspects. I'm your host, Gaurav Chaudhary. This is a series about unraveling stories of entrepreneurs, investors, and businesses, professionals, and of course, philanthropists who are disruptors yet not in your face. Their disruptions have consistently delivered on the purpose and the mission they've embarked on. Their values are as strong as the mission. Unusual Suspects streams on earshot.in, spotify.com, Apple Podcasts, YouTube Podcasts, moneycontrol.com, and a host of other podcast streaming platforms and directories. Welcome to the fourth season of Catalyzing Change, the Power of Philanthropy, in collaboration with GivingPi, India's first family-focused philanthropy network. Dasra's research on philanthropy highlights that Indian families are an integral part of the Indian economy, contributing approximately 40% to private philanthropy. They contribute through personal giving and CSR initiatives by family-owned and family-run businesses. As wealth increases and transitions across generations, Indian families are reshaping the philanthropic landscape through investments in bold ideas, funding newer focus areas, and taking a more intentional, system-focused approach to giving. Over the last few seasons, we have spotlighted how philanthropists are stepping up in often overlooked spaces, from mental health and gender equity to animal welfare and the arts. In season four, we look to the future. Through conversations with philanthropists and change makers, we'll explore emerging trends, fresh approaches, and what they signal for the evolving future of Indian philanthropy. This episode explores how members of the Indian diaspora are engaging more deeply with India's social sector through philanthropic support that goes beyond one-time donations. By contributing their ideas, resources, and networks, they're becoming an important part of India's philanthropic landscape and helping to strengthen India's nonprofits. Joining us for this episode is Nankishore Kalambi, endearingly called as Andy by his friends and peers. With over 25 years of leadership experience in enterprise technology, Andy has helped scale innovative digital solutions across global markets. Having driven the digital transformation journeys for several Fortune 100 companies and participated on the boards of multinational corporations for over 12 years, he has built a global network with business leaders, investors, and senior enterprise leadership. He also serves as the chairperson of the Ashoka Trust for Research in Ecology and Environment, ACTRI, USA, where he helps engage philanthropists, foundations, and corporations in the US to enhance the impact of environmental and developmental programs in India. Andy, delighted to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. I am delighted as well. It has been an interesting journey in the last few years, and I hope to be sharing some of that with your audience.
Absolutely. Andy, you know, let's start off with a basic context setting question just for our own understanding and my own understanding and the understanding of our listeners and audience. You know, it's about your journey, as you said, and you come from the world of business. Let's take a step back and let's look behind a bit. What was that? Was there a trigger, or was there some kind of a eureka moment, or was there something that sparked your journey into philanthropy? What actually ensured or prompted you to get onto this journey of philanthropy and the social sector? Because you've been deeply associated with the world of corporates and corporations in a very, very different function. What are the values that shaped your approach along the way? What made you get into this journey? What are the values that have actually, you know, made you, shaped you along the way so that there's a certain attitude and philosophy you stick to?
My first, I would say about 25, 30 years in my career have been mostly, as you rightly observed, in the corporate life. And mostly with large companies as well as with startups. So I've done a sprinkling of startups, but most of my life has been with two large companies, SAP and a French company called Dassault Systèmes. And during that course, it took me across multiple countries. I've lived about close to 30 years outside India. Even though I've lived outside India, I've never been too far away from India. Most of my career, I've done things which have been related to India. I started the SAP office in India in 95. I came back through Dassault Systèmes for a couple of years as the managing director of Dassault Systèmes India. And I have always been involved in ventures in India. So India has always been close to my heart, and my mother still lives. She's 94 years old and she still lives in India. So, you know, I have deep roots in India. Currently, I live in Boston. I've been in the US for the last 12 years. And I started dipping my toes in philanthropy, I would say about 20 plus years back, when I got involved in a school project in the coastal part of Karnataka. This is North Canara, as it is called. And there was a new school that was being set up. It was a free school, and they didn't really have money to operate the school. And I started a program there where the school children would be funded. And I became the first person to put in some money to fund them. And that thereby my journey in philanthropy started. But it was still very, I would say, not very strategic, I would say. It was tactical. I was focused only on that school, and then eventually in a gender equity program there, which resulted in a social enterprise. But my involvement was more to donate money, occasionally visit those areas, give some ideas, but not very deep involvement because I was busy with my corporate career. It was around 2021 that I exited my last corporate role. And that's when I was thinking about what I should do next. And my guiding principle in my life in the recent times has been the Bhagavad Gita. And as I delved deeper into the Gita, I realized that there was something more that needed to be done with my life. So I started out a different chapter in my life. And here, I reversed the playbook a little bit. I decided that I would spend much more time on the nonprofit world and giving my time rather than working in the corporate, you could say, the treadmill that you have in the corporate life. And that's how I got into this phase of my life, which is completely dedicated now, or largely dedicated, I would say, to nonprofit and primarily dedicated to one area. That area is around nature, biodiversity, and climate-related issues. So that's really my focus currently. Does that give you a sense a little bit, Gaurav?
Yeah, absolutely. It gives you a great idea about, you know, how this journey began and how far you have come. But tell me a little bit more about your work with Atri. You know, it's something that you have been deeply involved. You are now the chairperson of that, where you are engaging with philanthropists, foundations, and corporations, particularly in the U.S., with a focus to enhance the impact of environmental and developmental programs in India. What drew you to the organization and inspired such deep involvement with this?
I would say the work with Atri started only 3 or 4 years back, but the roots of it has got laid in my 2 year stint in Japan. I was living in Japan from 2007 to 2009, and I discovered the way the Japanese lived. They were very respectful of the environment. They were very nature centered. They looked at nature as a source of everything. And to some extent, our Indian civilization has been very nature centered as well. So that's where my initial interest started. But there, at that time, it was more focused on climate and climate related issues. It was somewhere around, I mean, about 5 or 6 years back that I met Professor Kamal Bawa. Professor Kamal Bawa is the founder of Atri. Ashoka Trust for Research in Ecology and Environment. He's an eminent professor from UMass Boston, but more importantly, he's possibly the most celebrated and the most eminent professor in the area of what is called conservation biology. He literally wrote the book on conservation biology. And he set up this organization and he invited me to come and visit them in Bangalore. They have a beautiful campus in Bangalore. And then I happened to go to one of their sites in a place called Biligiri Rangan Hills, which is in the Western Ghats. And I happened to see something that really changed my thinking. They have something called a community conservation center, which is run by a community, a Soliga community, which is an Adivasi community. And there I happened to come across a whole range of new topics, agroforestry, livelihoods being created based on nature's principles. And as I started looking at this topic, I realized that the real war, of course, everyone is focused on climate and figuring out how to stem the issues on climate change. But I realized that the bigger war was around biodiversity. And biodiversity involves nature, involves all the things that we are losing in nature. And it has many topics related to it, climate being one of them. So I agreed to come on the board of ATRI, and I've been focused since then. The India focus there has been even more important because I think India is growing very fast. India has a very ambitious vision for India 2047. And I strongly believe that India is going to be a significant economic player. It's already is, and it's going to be even more so. But to support that economic, I would say, growth, India needs a thoughtful approach and not the kind of problems that we see in the West right now. And I think nature provides a lot of answers. And that's how I've got into this space. I feel that, while we are developing economically, we also need to pay attention to nature, to biodiversity, and ensure that what really keeps us alive, what is the reason why we are in existence, we need to preserve that.
Absolutely. Clearly this demonstrates the kind of deeper learnings that has come about because of the association and the work that they're doing with an institution like ATRI. But my question is a little more focused, and you did talk about India being a significant economic player, which we already are, and probably even more by 2047 as we get along. We are the fourth largest, and we'll probably get into the top three club very soon. Now, the question, however, is that because it's a growing economy, the negative externalities that comes about on so far as the ecology and environment is concerned is a necessary evil, if I may say so, that we cannot bypass, because we have to balance the demands of a growing economy with the ecological necessities. How do we go about achieving that? Because it's a trade. At some point, we have to make a trade-off. And how do we go about actually achieving that optimal trade-off between ecological necessities and economic demand?
Gaurav, that's an excellent point, Gaurav. And because I've come from the business world, most of the conversations around biodiversity have been more science-based, more related to scientists. And when I came from the business side, I realized that the problem is not about the work that is being done by the scientist and the ecologist. The problem is really a business problem and an economic problem. And that's how it was when I started my life in the climate change world in 2007, when very few people talked about climate change in the business area. And now, if you look at it, it has become a mainstream topic. So the question really is, how do we make these trade-offs? How do we ensure that we are able to build something which does not come at the expense of what keeps us in existence? The economic model that we have followed in the last several hundred years has been what I would call an extractive model, an extractive economic model which looks at extracting from nature and not really paying the real cost of what nature provides. And I came across this concept called the five capital model, which looks at all the capitals, the four capitals of, you know, how we measure traditionally GDP, which is financial and manufactured capital, and also looking at human and social capital that supports that. But what is not put into the balance sheet is what is called natural capital. And there's no way of measuring it correctly. There's no way of ensuring that it comes on the balance sheet. And there's no way of looking at the thing that you talked about is trade-off. How does one do the right amount of extraction from nature while maintaining enough for the future? And there's a whole new area coming up called regenerative thinking. And that's something that I've been working with, especially in Atri, looking at how does one look at changing the model. And I think in India, there's a lot of thought around it. I've heard people talking about circular economy, circular business models, regenerative thinking. There's a whole new movement around agriculture, which is about how do you transform the current form of industrialized agriculture to a more ecologically friendly regenerative agriculture. So these are the ways in which we can achieve economic success, but also not run out of critical resources like clean air, water, see widespread destruction of species. India is very blessed to have, it's a mega diverse country in terms of biodiversity. It has some of the best and most diverse ecosystems. It has species which don't exist anywhere in the world. This is really our true capital. And as we develop, I think the question is, can we reorient our economy? And I think India is doing that. I think if you look at the recent report on renewables, India is almost, I think I was told, 50% now generating its energy requirements through renewables. So I think there are ways and means in which the economic model can be transitioned into a more nature-positive, regenerative model, which will not just create wealth for the traditional form of wealth, which is economic wealth, but also create natural wealth. And that is what I'm really engaged with through Atri.
Absolutely. And you really touched upon a very significant point, which is how the economic model of the growth models, rather, of the previous 100 or 200 years has largely been extractive, where now it's about time to actually move the needle fully and decisively towards a regenerative economic model, which is why I think businesses should move from a pure profit maximization motive to some kind of a new B2C kind of a language, which essentially means business to climate rather than only business to consumer. Many thanks for those insights, Andy. But let me change tack a bit and let me ask you something about the India's diaspora community. And for members of diaspora like you, who's a deep, as you said right at the outset, that you have been away from India, but not very far from India, always, which is a very nice way of putting the deep connections that you continue to have with the roots in India. And there are millions like you who do. So the members of the diaspora who feel a strong connection, very strong connection to India, but are unsure of how to meaningfully begin their philanthropic journey, what would your advice be?
Gaurav, I think it's important to look at philanthropy now strategically and tactically. And a lot of approach to philanthropy has been more emotion-driven, more driven by, I would say, pet projects that we feel strongly about. But philanthropy is beyond that. Philanthropy is creating impact. Philanthropy is about moving the needle. And the fact is that there has been a significant, I would say, social inequity that has come in the last few years. There has been a lot of wealth concentration that is happening. Part of it is just systemic, the way the economic system works. And this is where the philanthropists play a role in ensuring that they maintain that social contract that we have with the people all around us. So I would say the approach that I have taken is to look at just the way one looks at a portfolio of investments, and looks at what are the strategic goals that one has to achieve the best possible return, I think philanthropy has to be viewed in a strategic fashion. It has to be also looked at from a portfolio fashion, which means today I'm invested not just in Atri. Atri is my 90% of my work and a lot of my philanthropy as well, but I'm also associated with a couple of other organizations. But everything eventually focuses on a bigger objective. My bigger objective personally is biodiversity and nature, and specifically India. So that's my bigger objective. Within which I'm looking at a portfolio of activities which are around what Atri does, and Atri does a phenomenal job. Atri is now ranked, last year it was recognized as one of the 40 change makers by Stanford. Just a word about Atri so that people know what Atri is. Atri is a 30-year-old organization. It has three elements in it. It's very unique in the world because it has taken an approach where it takes research, very deep science-based research, and puts it into action, and then also looks at how to influence policy. So it has an academy which churns out PhD level and master's level people for creating capacity. It has an action research organization which works at taking a lot of the research that is being done and putting it into practice in conservation, in restoration, in community-based, livelihood-based approaches of engaging forest-based communities. And it is working in the most iconic landscapes of India, in Himalayas, Western Ghats, parts of Tamil Nadu, Maharashtra. So it has got a wide impact, both a wide and a deep impact. And it has, I would say, 200 of the best ecologists, environmentalists, people, practitioners who are working on these problems. So I think philanthropists need to step back and not just look at this purely as an emotion-driven but as a very strategic activity. And some philanthropists are doing a marvelous job. I must say that India philanthropists, and I work with different people all over the world, I'm really impressed by the way Indian philanthropists have taken some of the toughest problems and started ventures. The only thing I would say is there's a good appreciation on climate now. I would want a bigger focus on biodiversity, nature. And I think there are two reasons to it. One is that it is a really big problem. Anyone who steps into any city in India, I think the first most visible sign of nature's problem is clean air. We don't breathe any more clean air in most cities in India. So I think we have a right to clean air, in my opinion, which is the most basic of every requirement. And I think there's a lot more focus required on that topic. So I would say, from a philanthropy perspective, the most important objectives should be taken from a more strategic perspective. I hope I'm answering your question, Gaurav.
Absolutely. And finally, Andy, you know, let's look into the crystal ball a little bit. Let's gaze into the future a bit. If you look into the future, we're looking at 2047 as a significant milestone because we complete 100 years of independence. What will it take to unlock the full potential of diaspora philanthropy for India's long-term transformation, keeping 2047 in mind, for instance, Andy?
Gaurav, 2047 is a wonderful goal, in my opinion, because it is long enough to create significant impact. It is also something which will... So it's about 20 plus years. And I believe that in 20 years, you can actually see results because you are taking one generation, a generational approach, especially on some of the bigger problems relating to nature, relating to topics which require one generation to kind of make the change. So I think that is a wonderful goal. I think what should be done is to visualize what India 2047 really would look like and then work backwards. I call it backcasting and say, where are we today? And then break it up into 5-year milestones and figure out what will we achieve. Because sometimes the 2047 milestone can look too much in the future. And while we can paint rosy pictures about that 2047, the ground realities are much more grimmer. And if we don't make changes now in the next 5 years, then it's unlikely that we'll reach those goals. So I think while setting that goal and doing some visualization of that environment and saying, okay, will we have in 2047 cities which will be completely, let's say we'll have more of indoors. Indore is ranking now as one of the cleanest cities. I happen to visit there. But will every city become like Indore? Will every city will have traffic issues resolved? Okay, so those kind of, I think, visual, goals need to be set. And then work backwards towards saying, look at what are we going to do in the next 5 years? And then what are we going to do in the next 1 to 2 years? And then how do we ensure that our philanthropic initiatives align to those kind of that roadmap? So I would say that could be an approach. That's at least the approach I am taking. I set up a 2047 document for myself. I set it up with a five-year kind of roadmap. And I looked at what could be the tipping point projects that I could be associated with, which will ensure that if I hit the tipping point in the 5 years, then it creates a virtuous cycle that then sustains itself over the next 15.
Yeah, indeed, very, very interesting insights on how India should go about, particularly the diaspora philanthropy should go about contributing to India's transformation and which India is seeking to achieve by 2047. Thank you, Andy. Thank you so much for sharing your deep insights and perspective on a range of issues. Thank you for taking the time out and dropping by to have this conversation with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Gaurav.